This program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Joanna LaForgia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting content from the November 2025 issue of Southern Living Magazine. This, listeners, is our last episode of this month for this issue. And we're going to hear this week, we're going to finish the cover story that we began last week about the untold story of Charleston Receipts. And we'll just revisit the first paragraph or so of that piece so that just to situate ourselves again there. And, of course, we're going to start with the last page of the magazine. Every last page, the feature is called Southern Journal, and it's written by Rick Bragg, B-R-A-G-G. So we'll start with that, and then we'll finish with our cover story. We might have time to do a little more, we'll see. We'll visit some places in the South if we do. All right, are you ready? Southern Living Magazine, the cover has Lainey Wilson. Some of you might have seen her hosting the CMA Awards and being awarded and lauded quite a bit there. All right, so she's at her farmhouse outside Nashville. The tone of this cover is all hard to for me to describe. It is peach and a dusty burnt orange. It looks the way autumn feels, the tones and the colors here, including what she's wearing, Lainey Wilson, as she is relaxed on her sofa in her farmhouse outside Nashville. And from the top to bottom, the cover reads, Southern Living, November 2025, Lainey Wilson's Tennessee home, celebrating in style with country's biggest star. And across the bottom, the only pie crust you'll ever need, Thanksgiving sides from our archives, the lost art of cane syrup, why Cajun turkey is just better, plus the untold story of Charleston Receipts, which we will get to in just a short time, listeners. All right. Back to our Southern Journal that ends every issue, since this is our last November episode. Southern Journal, don't fumble the turkey. Mama always made it look easy. Then she asked me to help. And this starts off with a cartoon of Rick Bragg. It is a caricature of Rick Bragg. So he's got an oversized head. And he has kind of a bulbous nose, brown hair, receding hairline, and a mustache and beard that is both brown and white. Again, this is a caricature. It's a drawing. And he's got a gold plaid shirt on. It's open and a black t-shirt underneath, and he's wearing blue jeans, black sneakers. He is chasing a cooked turkey in a parking lot, a supermarket parking lot. We know because it says supermarket on the store. So he's in a parking lot. Some of the car's trunks or boots are open, and there's a shopping cart that's empty, so he's running and chasing this turkey, which appears to be flying. It is off the ground, but close to the ground, so he's kind of bending down to try to catch it. And there's a woman in the background looking at him in surprise there. All right, here we go. For most of my life, I had nothing to do with getting ready for Thanksgiving. I would wake up on that morning to the aroma of roasting turkey, and all I had to do was present myself at the table, more or less washed, and enjoy. Just a few days before, that turkey had been an ice-hard, unappetizing lump. But by dinner time, it was golden brown, buttery perfection. I did not know all the work it took, or the years and years of experience. And I did not need to. We have a saying here. He's so dumb he could even mess up a Thanksgiving turkey. I believed that was meant specifically for me. I didn't even like to be in the same room with the bird till the blessing was winding down. And even then, it could be tricky. Among the Pentecostals, grace was not complete until the words "Our Father" had been intoned 37 times. The record is 73. We blessed everything but the cats. Everyone knows they play for the other side. The point is, I did not risk any involvement in the process until a drumstick was safely between my teeth. But years passed, and people I love left us, or just got old. Till one day, not long ago, my mother asked for help. "Please, God, no," I replied. So I find myself deep in the mystery, and it has become a thing of dread. The finished product is still wonderful. But now I know how it happens, and that I truly can ruin it. It all starts with the purchase of the proper poultry. "Now, hon, we want a small, young turkey. And not too small and not too young," my mother informs me. "Anywhere between 10 and 12 pounds. "So, 11? I ask. "Or more," she says. "Okay," I say. "Or less," she replies. Mama gives me the brands she has had luck with in the past and those that have disappointed her. Unfortunately for me, most of the names appear on both lists. I am told that the more expensive ones, like Butterball, might not be the best bets. Only rich people get them, so they may have been lying around a while, she says. Store brands are fine. "From which stores?" I ask. She disremembers. But the selection is easy compared to the transportation. One time, when I was little, I let a turkey slip through my fingers in the parking lot of the A&P grocery. It rolled about 30 yards. Once it's finally in the house, it must be moved from room to room, like we want it to get to know us good before being cooked. It begins in the upstairs freezer, so it can be examined. But that soon fills up with other treats, so I am told to usher it to the bigger one downstairs. 2 days prior to Thanksgiving, it goes into that floor's refrigerator. On the night before, it moves back to the main level fridge. Then, late in the evening, I run it a bath of cold water. Finally, on Thursday morning, I get to heave it into a pan and put it in the oven. Then, around noon, I drag it out. "I'm 88 years old," she tells me. "I can't lick them big turkeys no more." "It's only a small one," I remind her. But after she gives me the look, I recall that a traveling turkey is better than none at all. Still, I dream back to a simpler time, when it just appeared, like in the story of the cobbler, the elves, and the shoes. It was a magic turkey. "No," Mama replies, "it was not." And that's our Southern Journal for November, listeners. Now we'll move on to the story of Charleston Receipts. And this is the title, listeners, as you might recall, if you heard, listened to our last episode, of a community cookbook. So again, we'll just read the beginning to resituate ourselves, and then we'll pick up from where we left off last time. All right? The Unwritten Chapters of Charleston Receipts. 75 years after it was first published, this legendary title has a complicated legacy, by Adrian Miller. I am a cookbook person. The older, the better. I was downright giddy when I first saw a well-worn 1956 edition of Charleston Receipts in a used bookstore about a decade ago. I eagerly flipped through it, wondering what recipes I'd salivate over, how it compared to the original 1950 version, and what clues it contained about the city's unique food culture. Given what I already knew about the extensive black contributions to Charleston, South Carolina's cuisine, I noticed that only a few African Americans were explicitly mentioned, and I yearned for more backstory. Searching for it took me on a journey that unfolded in ways I never expected. Even by today's standards, Charleston Receipts is a powerhouse. It is the oldest cookbook still in continuous print, published by the Junior League, which is an organization with chapters across the world, training women to be effective volunteers and leaders. All right. And listeners, the picture of this book has a binder. It's got one of those it appears to be white plastic binders on the side. So, and it's a very dark green, like a dark forest, greenish and gray mix of that. And Charleston Receipts is written in that very old-timey font. There is pictures of stagecoaches going along the top. And in the center, there is a map of Charleston. And it appears to be a very aged map because it's got horses and big schooners and things. Just gives you a very, very ancient kind of feeling. And it is of Charleston, the coast of South Carolina along the Atlantic Ocean, of course. It says Charleston on the top of the map, Receipts on the bottom, America's oldest junior league cookbook in print. And Receipts, listeners, I can't find it here exactly where it said it, but we learned last time that it's called Receipts because these recipes were given down orally. That's not why. They were given down orally, and they're called receipts because when people wrote them down and heard and handed them to someone, or even when they told them to someone, that person who received the recipe. So that's why they're called receipts, things that were received. All right, so we'll pick up our story now where we left off. And this section is called Searching for Ada. And there is a photo of, I'm guessing it might be Ada. The disconnect between that photograph and the caption is representative of the way African-American contributions have been written out of the story of this immensely popular book. And it's a bunch, three women and a man, Caucasian, who are at a very crowded lunch table and enjoying each other and smiling and conversing. And then there is a waitress in apron, in the old traditional style with a cap as well, who is African-American, and she is serving them. And she's in the background. All right, back to our story, Searching for Ada. Some of Cohen's prized possessions are several large scrapbooks containing memorabilia documenting the book's history. As she flipped through one, her face beaming with pride, a photograph shown above, the one that we just looked at, listeners, the photograph from the Post and Courier caught my eye. In 1951, the nationally syndicated food journalist Clementine Paddleford accepted an invitation from Huguenin to visit her home and sample recipes from Charleston Receipts. The Post and Courier reported on this momentous occasion with an article that included a photo of Paddleford seated at the dining table along with the Huguenin family. In the center of the picture, an African-American woman in a domestic worker's uniform was busy preparing to serve the meal. The caption listed everyone's name except hers. Who was she? Cohen mentioned that for 2 months, the family's African-American cook, Ada, tested most of the dishes in their kitchen. I wondered whether she could have contributed to the book in a meaningful way that went unnoted. Was it possible that some of Ada's recipes were included but went uncredited? Curiosity and a sense of justice fueled my search to learn more about Ada. In the beginning, it didn't seem daunting. How hard could it be when I knew her first name, her employer, the city where she worked, and her race? When my amateur sleuthing was unsuccessful, I reached out to reference specialists at the Avery Research Center, the International African American Museum, IAAM, and the South Carolina Department of Archives and History, as well as other institutions. But without a last name, no one could identify her. With the help of the IAAM, I was able to track down a woman named Anna Smalls, who worked for the Huguenin family during the 1940s and early 1950s. I spoke to Smalls' descendants, but they couldn't remember her ever mentioning Charleston receipts. Some relatives, longtime Charleston area residents, had never heard of the cookbook. The mystery deepened. This disconnect between that photograph and the caption is representative of the way African-American contributions have been written out of the story of this immensely popular book. Acclaimed author and historian Tony Tipton Martin has written about how this was a common practice in old recipe collections. Many historical records portrayed the white women as the primary knowledge holders, but their constant references to black women in their written documents and in observations by outsiders contradict that narrative, she says. Tipton Martin notes that this is evident in Charleston receipts. The recipes, images, and commentary prove that the black women held knowledge too, whether it was acknowledged or not. The book is a product of an era when attributing credit to servants of any kind would not have been expected. The times have changed. The labor of low country cooking. Much of this book's historical value lies in its documentation of black culinary and cultural knowledge. Significant numbers of enslaved Africans passed through Sullivan's Island off Charleston's coast en route to the city, surrounding areas, and other parts of the South. In the early decades of slavery, enslaved Africans outnumbered white residents in Charleston. On the eve of the Civil War, black people made up 42.3% of the city's population. And by the time Charleston Receipts was published, the percentage had increased slightly to 44%. Their influence could not be ignored or downplayed in any authentic representation of low country cooking. The book has numerous recipes with ingredients that were already familiar to West Africans in the 18th century, like bene, sesame seeds, and that's spelled, listeners, B as in boy, E-N-N-E, black-eyed peas, okra, and peanuts, called goobers or ground nuts. Its rice recipes are an important and tragic reminder that Africans were primarily brought to this region to exploit their prior expertise with African rice to farm an Asian variety that would later be nicknamed Carolina Gold because of its color and economic value. Typical of that time period, many of the black cooks who regularly made the food featured in Charleston receipts went uncredited in lieu of the white people who employed them. Testaments abound to their arduous labor. Lewis Y. Dawson, Jr., then president of the Otranto Club, shared a recipe for Otranto pine bark stew that he attributed to his father. Yet the instructions begin by having a woman named Patsy, quote, make an outdoor fire of pine bark, then have her slice about one dozen Irish potatoes and about one dozen small onions, unquote. It further details the steps to make the layered dish and accompanying sauce. Presumably, Patsy did the hours of work necessary to create this delicacy. Still, there are a few recipes by black cooks who are noted for their culinary contributions, like John Dent's coleslaw, or Maum, M-A-U-M, which is a local variant of Mammy, Nancy Scalloped Oysters, and Samuel Faber's Pilau, P-I-L-A-U, Pilau, I think that might be pronounced. All right, rethinking Charleston receipts. And listeners, just let me repeat, that was Mom Nancy's Scalloped Oysters, just to be sure that that came across the way it was intended there. Okay, rethinking Charleston receipts. Like other books about Lowcountry life in that era, the pages are peppered with Gullah Geechee verses, the linguistic heritage of the West African descendants who live in the region, along with English interpretations. The foreword includes a note from the late Virginia Mixon Garrity, a white instructor at the College of Charleston who spent much of her life working to preserve the Gullah language. Garrity, who provided the English translations, wrote, "Special dishes like champagne punch, James Island shrimp pie, and Dawes Browning were generally prepared and served by Lowcountry cooks and butlers. The Gullah lines allow readers to meet these special people, share their humor, and hear, quote-unquote, their language." However well-intentioned at the time, those sentences and their translations were presented from a perspective outside the Gullah Geechee community rather than from within it. As a cookbook, it is influential in the fact that it is a preservation of the great recipes of the Lowcountry, says Mitchell. As a historical document, to me, it embodies the erasure and appropriation of the labor and creativity of black people. In a step toward reckoning with this, the JLC is working with Mitchell and Dr. Bernard Powers, director of the Center for the Study of Slavery in Charleston, and Professor Emeritus of History at the College of Charleston, on a new foreword to the book, and they're considering whether the recipe should be preserved as found, quote-unquote, or updated. Through this work, we want to give African-descended cooks a higher profile and ensure their culinary talents are recognized, says Powers. This will expand the original book's modern appeal while retaining its value as a historical artifact. Unquote. Because the initial contributors and cooks are no longer with us, and the memories of those who knew them have dimmed, we may never know the depth of the African-American influence on the book. Like the unnamed woman in the photograph, it's a stark reminder that whenever someone tries to reflect a community, it's important to include everyone involved. Even an enduring and iconic cookbook can have unwritten chapters. And listeners, we end this article with a photo at the bottom, and it takes up about 20% of the page, or maybe a little less. And it is a photograph of several scrapbooks. They are in three whole loose leaf binders, and they're opened, and though we can't read them, we can see that they are all recipes, and there's even a photograph in a few of them. And Many of them appear to be taken from old newspapers, perhaps that Post and Courier, I would guess. And they are thick, seem to be quite a few, even though they're opened here. You can see there are quite a few pages well-preserved in plastic covers to these books. And the photograph at right, there's a small photograph of an African-American man wearing black glasses. He has a white beard, and he's bald, and a blue shirt. And a Caucasian woman, she has white hair. She's an elderly woman. And she has on a navy blue blouse with some scattered flowers on it. They are both smiling, and they are leafing through these aforementioned books, these loose leaf binders. And there is a brick wall behind them that has some photographs that we can't see, or paintings that are blurred. And the caption of this photo is, from left, books that we just saw, these are articles and clippings that fill Cohen's scrapbooks. Writer Adrian Miller, at left, that was the man, and Vereen Cohen stand in her Charleston home where the book was created. And again, listeners, that is Charleston Receipts is the name of the book, and it is America's oldest junior league cookbook in print. That's what it says on the cover, if you're looking to research that further. We have about less than 2 minutes left, so we're just going to talk a little bit about Alabama's secret fall. There's a little bit more fall left, I think, down there, where you can explore quaint towns that come alive in autumn. And here are some places that you can stay. Here's how you can plan your own Alabama adventure, which is the title of this short piece. Choose a place to stay, and then set out for a fun fall weekend. It says here, Mentone is the town. M as in Mary, E-N-T as in Thomas, O-N-E, Mentone Inn, Bed and Breakfast. I'm just going to give you the names of the places since we're running out of time. Then there's Mentone Mountain Getaways, and those are private cabins and tiny homes and cottages. The Bee on the Brow Bed and Breakfast is a modern stay on a 3-acre property that has an on-site trail and a 2-course breakfast served daily in the dining room. And DeSoto State Park. You can opt for one of the multi-room cabins, A-frame chalets, campsites, and motel rooms that are available in the park. And that's it for today's episode of Southern Living. I hope you enjoyed it and hope you'll listen next time. I'm Joanna LaForgia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once more, that's 919-832-5138. So long until next time.